Let's start out, and if you could, can you give me a brief bio of yourself?
I did my graduate work in economics and business in the San Francisco Bay Area. I was a graduate student at the University of California, Berkeley campus, first in the MBA program and then thereafter in the economics program. And my area really very quickly became third world countries. So the work I've been doing, the teaching I've been doing here now for over a quarter century has been in the area of the third world, largely, on third world economic development, social change, and so on. And, you know, Afghanistan sort of fits into that. I had begun a research project, the social economic transformations in Afghanistan during the 20th century. Afghanistan, it turns out, is a really interesting country to look at in terms of social transformations in the process of what we call becoming a so-called modern nation, which is not a unmitigated blessing. And I think that Afghanistan is a great country to use to show that. It actually sort of changed my focus for a bit. I was, for the last 2 years, 2.5 years, I've been working on Brazil, also putting together a huge empirical database, but of course on a very different kind of topic. And my dissertation way back in the late 1970s was also based on putting together an enormous empirical database. So I've been doing this kind of stuff for, 2 to 3 decades. So this was actually a relatively easy one compared to some of the other things I've been working on in the past.
So what specifically was the motivation in producing this report, a dossier on civilian victims of United States aerial bombing in Afghanistan? What made you stop working on Brazil, for instance?
Well, I, like you and your viewers undoubtedly, were very much looking at television and reading the national mainstream press on October 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, and I was simply not getting a picture of the war. The war seemed to end once airplanes had taken off of the flight deck of the Carl Vinson, and we didn't know anything about what happened after that. There were some rather stale and uninformative press conferences at the Pentagon, which were not revealing, and they certainly didn't give anybody a qualitative sense of what was happening in Afghanistan. And I simply turned off the television and decided, well, there must be other places around where I can find out about that part of the war, what I guess I consider the real part of the war, which is, you know, how have Afghan people fared, how have they experienced this, what has happened, and the like. And I went to work on it using largely foreign sources because very, very few reports were made in this country. In fact, in the early weeks, the only incidents, if we want to call them that, the only bombing incidents which were reported were those which were in some way or another connected with the West, such as when the United Nations demining agency was bombed, I believe on the second or third day of the bombing raids. That was reported with 4 civilian casualties, which was correct. And then a few days later, the jet airplanes hit the Red Cross facility in Kabul, setting it ablaze. And luckily, nobody was killed there. A few were injured, and an enormous amount of material was destroyed. So I got this sense that there was a big war out there, which nobody wanted to talk about, at least in this country. However, I quickly found out that there were many other places in the world where this was reported, albeit in very scattered fashion. So there would be reports in Pakistan and in India, and actually the Australians have reported quite widely and in fairly detailed manner of some of the things which were going on. And I decided that, well, somebody had to put this whole story together, and I was encouraged to do so by friends of mine who were familiar with past research I've done. And in fact, a couple of them said, "Mark, you know, you're probably the best person in this country to put this kind of thing together." And I said, "Well, maybe. I'm going to think about that. Give me 24 hours to think about this before I launch into it," because I knew it was going to be a difficult and a very time-consuming project. So around October 20th, I decided to get into this, and I did it. There are a whole bunch of sort of subtexts which are involved here also, and I think these are important subtexts. For example, one of them is, this raises serious questions about the accuracy of the weaponry which is used. It raises serious questions about the media reporting which is done in the mainstream in this country. And, you know, I think it raises a very serious question about the decision of military planners in the United States to go ahead and carry out a type of bombing which would necessarily have significant civilian casualties. And in so doing, it raises a question. It's an unfortunate question, but that doesn't mean we should avoid it, a question about the differential value put on different people's lives. And I think that it really, the first 3 weeks of the bombing, which is kind of phase one of the air war, we had a large cumulative number of civilian casualties as a direct result of bombing relatively small military facilities in urban areas. And when one bombs these facilities in urban areas with the kind of impact weaponry, the size of the bombs and such, there are going to be civilian casualties. And it's inescapable, and it's in some ways necessary. That was then followed later by phase two and phase three of the air war, which were somewhat different. So these three other things I've mentioned here were really subtexts of the overall thing, which was simply to tell the story as well as possible, as rigorously as possible, of what was happening once the airplanes left the end of the Carl Vinson flight deck. You know, there are other kind of subsidiary things which I was interested in, and that was how, for example, the civilian casualties in the Afghan war would compare with Kosovo, would compare with Iraq, which was a very, very different kind of air war and ground war, actually, and you know, maybe even all the way back to Vietnam. It turns out there is a literature on this, not a very rich literature, but there is one, and I was interested in contributing to that and seeing how Afghanistan would fit.
You mentioned some of your sources. I wonder if you could go into that in a little more detail. Exactly what were your sources?
Well, I've used an enormous amount of international sources. Many are located in, these are major newspapers. That's basically what I used, were major newspaper reports available on the web, actually. So you can read the national level papers published in Pakistan and in India and many European papers. The British were actually terrific in terms of the detail of the reporting. Newspapers like The Independent, The Guardian did a wonderful job. But The Scotsman, The Irish Times, a large number of kind of national level newspapers did some pretty detailed reporting of civilian casualties. It's interesting that they did, but nobody over here did. There's a significant difference here. And then I used news agency reports like Agence France-Presse and the AP, of course, the Afghan Islamic Press, the South African Broadcasting Corporation, and so on. So there were the more traditional sort of news agencies like Reuters, Agence France-Presse, national-level newspapers, and then occasionally I was able to find some reports by non-governmental organizations. And in particular, there's an Italian medical doctor, nurse unit active in the general Kabul area, which treated bombing injured persons. And they wrote up very detailed reports. So I was able to use some of their material. But also the reports written up by the Afghan Women's Association, which goes under the acronym of RAWA, R-A-W-A, which I would highly recommend. I think their reporting has been terrific. I wish there were more of it, but that which was out there I did use. And, you know, occasionally there were, I don't want to say there were no articles in the mainstream U.S. press. I mean, there were. I've cited in the data, which is publicly available, reports from the Chicago Tribune. The Los Angeles Times probably did more than others. The Washington Post, the Baltimore Sun. As I said before, also Australian newspapers. The Sydney Morning Herald was particularly good. Indian newspapers, the Times of India, which is the equivalent of our New York Times, had a daily, or sometimes two or three reports per day, on particular things happening on the ground in Afghanistan, and so I used those too. And all of these are available on the Internet, so I was really able to do this from here. I don't think it's complete. I wish I had the possibility of sort of being over there maybe for a month or two now or soon. I think that that would really enrich the study, but I feel really confident. And I think, as I've mentioned in the text and as I've spoken in different places, I think this is really an underestimate. When I'm saying that 3,770 civilians died between October 7th and December 6th, the real figure is more like 5,000. which in our terms in the United States, since Afghanistan has a population of one-tenth of the United States, that would be about 50,000 people, which, you know, you can just make the math, divide by 3,200, which is the current World Trade Center. This is many, many, many World Trade Center equivalents, which the Afghan population has experienced. So, you know, in terms of kind of cumulative pain experienced by a population, this is a big event.
So you used what many would call very reputable sources.
Oh, absolutely.
And
absolutely.
By the estimates on your report, we're looking at about 62 people a day.
That's correct.
Who are being killed.
That's correct.
Yet here in the U.S., when reporters would question even people in the White House, they would claim that they have no knowledge of what civilian deaths were. What's your opinion on why information wasn't getting out here to the American people and the effort being put behind that?
Well, I think that was a very conscious policy. And there are many instances where this was a conscious policy was revealed. When the White House and the Pentagon called in the major news agencies and basically said, you know, civilian casualties is not front page news. We don't want to see that there. The effort on the part of the Pentagon, which as of October 11th bought up all the commercial satellite imagery available, you and I could have actually bought this commercial satellite imagery, which was widely available to the American public, news reporters, everybody else. These are very detailed satellite images produced by the Iconos satellite system. This was simply bought up and monopolized by the Pentagon. This imagery was simply not available anymore to the American public. This was hardly reported in the U.S. press. On the other hand, there was a major article in the British Guardian which spoke precisely about this and, you know, speculated as to the reasons why this was done. I don't think that it was for security reasons or anything of that sort, because the Afghans knew where they were being hit. It was pretty obvious. They experienced it. So they didn't need the satellite imagery, but I think that that satellite imagery could have shown the extent of the devastation on the ground. And this was consciously kept away from the American public. I think that when Secretary Powell visited Qatar and reprimanded the independent Arab news agency Al Jazeera for its reporting from Afghanistan, this was simply another example of, we do not want images of the war coming into the United States. This was a taboo subject. Mr. Isaacson of CNN, in a very widely reported discussion internal to CNN, made it very clear that civilian casualties was not a priority and should not be discussed. When the White House goes out and hires the former chief executive officer of J. Walter Thompson advertising firm, Mrs. Reeves, to head up the marketing of the Afghan war for the American people, when it hires the Rendon Group, a major public relations firm, to package the presentation of the war to the American people, this too, I think, is, you know, you look at all of this together, and the picture comes out, I think, rather clearly, that this was, in effect, a project not terribly different from selling soap or selling whatever, a car. You market the war. And what would, I think, not have fit in that story would have been accurate reporting as to the damage on the ground. Whereas, as I, you know, I emphasized before, in Britain it was very different. In France it was very different. I just got back from Switzerland yesterday, and the Swiss reporting was different. This was a very conscious policy. I think this is another thing which is raised by this report, the lack, really, of independent, critical news gathering on the part of so many mainstream newspapers and certainly television channels.
And you mentioned Al Jazeera, which I believe also had their facility destroyed by U.S. bombs.
That's correct. When the Northern Front collapsed and the Taliban retreated, whether they retreated strategically or in disarray, one can, I guess, argue about that. But anyhow, retreated, and Kabul was vacated by them that very night. Al Jazeera was hit by a missile. And it's very difficult for me to believe that this was a coincidence. There were no military facilities around that area. And a second projectile, I'm not sure whether it was a missile or a bomb, landed very close by and actually damaged the BBC office, too. But I think the Al Jazeera thing was particularly vexing for the Pentagon and the State Department to have, you know, a very independent, critical news agency like Al Jazeera reporting direct from Kabul. Al Jazeera has sometimes been painted as a pawn of this or that. Well, you know, Al Jazeera has been attacked from all sides, and I think that's probably a pretty good indication of Al Jazeera doing some darn good independent reporting. It's been accused of being a pawn of Saudi Arabia, a pawn of Israel, et cetera, et cetera. And I think they were doing a, from what I could tell, you know, a pretty good job of on-site reporting. And many of their figures were actually figures which, you know, seemed to be mentioned elsewhere in what I found.
Address, if you would, the concept of the human shield, because whenever civilian casualties were brought up in the U.S. media, it was often pointed out that those were because the Taliban, in fact, marched or kept civilians in areas that they knew would be bombed by U.S. warplanes.
Well, I don't accept the human shield argument. Now, I'm not saying that isolated instances that might not have occurred. I don't know. But if somebody's familiar with the layout of military facilities in Afghanistan and the legacy of the Soviet era, and when Afghanistan in the 1980s had a government which was somewhat Soviet-leaning, and there was a major civil war, as probably everybody knows, the government, the central government, really only controlled the urban areas. And so, not surprisingly, that's where military garrisons were located. It's also, of course, the place where government buildings are located. It's also the place where things like telephone exchanges and things of that sort are located, and these were bombed. So I see this was a decision which was made on the part of U.S. military planners to bomb what they perceived to be, and I underline the word perceived, to be military-type facilities in urban areas. The Taliban did not have large military bases, such as we're familiar with in this country, whether it's Fort Bragg or Pendleton or others. It's a relatively decentralized military structure, which is, of course, not surprising. Afghanistan itself is a very, very decentralized society in every way. And you look at, for example, politics. It was very difficult, and I think it will be very difficult, to have a central administration, given the fragmentation into regions and so on. So the military facilities were relatively small, located in urban areas, and these were hit. And I think the reason they were hit was pretty clear, and that was that in the future, it might be that American troops would be involved on the ground, and it might very well be that low-flying American aircraft would be in the area. And if military facilities were still there, we were going to take casualties. And so I think that this decision was made, which in fact reflects a differential value put on life. And I know this is a very hard thing to say, but I do believe that this reveals a differential value on life. We will bomb what we perceive to be military facilities in urban areas today and necessarily kill Afghan civilians in the hope that this will prevent possible future casualties on our side. I don't believe that the Bush administration had a well-worked-out phase-by-phase war plan. I think that this evolved over time. And in the beginning and in the middle and possibly even at the end, there was a very serious possibility that U.S. forces would actually be on the ground fighting, which is something which has hardly happened at all in the course of the war so far. So the human shield argument is really largely irrelevant. And the bombing took place in urban areas because that was simply where military facilities were located. And the military bombed a whole series of installations in urban areas, such as the Kabul telephone exchange, but many other things too, which of course they were located in urban areas. And as to, you know, government buildings, well, they're going to be located in urban areas. They're not going to be located on the Somali plain or in the Kandahar desert. They're going to be located in Kandahar or in Kabul or in Mazar-i-Sharif or in Herat. And these were perceived to be legitimate targets and bombed. And so I really think that the human shield argument is a cover-up, really. It's not an accurate description of what was going on.
Yeah, I don't think it takes a great deal of imagination on Americans to see that we ourselves in our country, those same facilities, phone facilities, water facilities, electrical facilities, even the military bases.
Government
are,
buildings.
Yeah, are right downtown.
We're
surrounded by people's houses and where people work.
Of course. I mean, you know, where's government center in Boston? I mean, it's not out in Cape Cod. It's in downtown Boston. And then the Taliban, of course, put up anti-aircraft units, relatively small affairs, mounted on the back of trucks, you know, around these kind of government buildings. Well, it's, of course they're in urban areas. As I said before, I mean, they're not out in the Somali plain. So I want to go back to this. It is the decision to bomb the perceived military facilities in urban areas with, and this is a point we haven't really yet spoken about, and that is with weaponry, which is simply not as accurate as it is touted to be. And as a result, you necessarily get civilian casualties. If I could just make one comment here about what I am saying and what I'm not saying, I am not saying that U.S. military strategists and political elites in this country consciously went out to bomb civilian areas and slaughter civilians. Of course not. I don't believe that in this war that was the case. This is not Dresden. This is not Hiroshima. This is not Nagasaki. But the decision was made to carry out a certain type of bombing campaign which would necessarily have civilian victims in large numbers, too. I mean, we're not talking about a couple hundred here. We're talking about thousands. So that's what I'm saying as opposed to, you know, what I was mentioning before.
And so we're talking about a combination of where these facilities that they chose to bomb are located, as well as the ordnance that they're using. For instance, like the cluster bombs, where I understand a large percentage of those remain unexploded.
Absolutely. At around December 1st, there was an estimate that somewhere around 600 cluster bombs have been dropped. I think that's probably grossly underestimated. But let's just assume for the sake of it, 600 cluster bombs. And with 202 bomblets in each cluster bomb and a fail rate, a dud rate of about 12%, which seems to be the figure I'm generating from the literature on cluster bombs and past experiences and tests and so on, that leaves about 14,500 bomblets scattered around different parts of Afghanistan, presumably in areas where people are, because they weren't bombing the desert. They were bombing downtown Herat, downtown Kandahar, and so on. But then also, in the second and third phase of the air war, the front lines were bombarded with cluster bombs. And so you have out in the countryside a large number of these remnants of cluster bombs in the form of these bright yellow bomblets scattered around the countryside. And we already have a lot of reports of people being blown up by these bomblets, as they have been in Kosovo and elsewhere.
Which also happened to be the same color and size as the food packets we were dropping.
Right, which I suspect was just a result of some very sloppy decision-making and the like. Kind of akin to calling when President Bush in the beginning came out and called this war a crusade, but then quickly retracted it because that was obviously not a good way to characterize this. And then there was another error in terms of describing the particular campaign, which was really bungled, and then finally they came upon a name which seemed to be somewhat acceptable to them and the world out there. And a similar example of this kind of ignorance of Afghan society was the Pentagon report that, oh, well, yes, you know, indeed, one of our bombs sort of strayed off course in Herat and hit an old folks' home. Well, I'm sorry, there are no old folks' home in Afghanistan. Old people aren't carted off to old folks' homes in Afghanistan to stay within the family. So you didn't have any old folks' home. And I just think there's been an incredible ignorance of the reality of Afghan society and culture, and carries over into things such as the layout of the Taliban military infrastructure across the country and the legacy which they really inherited from the more Soviet-leaning government of the 1980s.
For those of you just tuning in, we are talking with Professor Mark Harold, who is with the University of New Hampshire and the author of a recent report, a dossier on civilian victims of United States aerial bombing in Afghanistan. So I'm wondering if I can have you go into some of the specific human stories that you came across, because so many of them, of what I saw in your report, were absolutely gripping, and I have to imagine as well, just you having to collect all this information must have at times been devastating to you.
It was very hard. It was a very difficult thing emotionally. I went to bed, midnight, 1 o'clock, after having worked on this for 10 or 12 hours a day, because that's really what it took. It took about 5 weeks of work, somewhere between 12 and 14 hours a day, and, you know, trying to put all this together. And, well, I went to bed, and most of the time, even though I was very tired, I didn't really sleep. It was a very chilling, agonizing, anguishing, and also angering thing to do. And I don't want to hide that. I think that's, it was very much reality. I guess the story, and as you mentioned, I mean, there are many scattered throughout the report. Actually, this one is not in the report. It's one which I just thought really was gripping. If I may, I'll just read this very slowly, and I think probably better said in the words of this report. With a family wedding 2 days away and the Taliban's front line positions more than 2 miles up the road, Coco Gol probably thought the jet noise was someone else's problem. Gol was in a second-floor room of her home Saturday afternoon, sewing clothes for her brother-in-law's wedding, as two U.S. fighter jets circled overhead, preparing to attack the Taliban. Instead, a bomb landed on Gol's home in a village controlled by the U.S. main allies, the Northern Alliance. So this was a bomb which actually fell on the so-called friendlies, as they're called. The bomb blast killed Gol and seriously wounded her son and daughter, ages 5 and 6, along with at least 7 other people. "We were planning for the wedding of my brother, who is now injured and in the hospital," said Gol's husband, Mirza Khan, who was slightly injured and was still trembling from the blast almost a day later. "I was taking care of the sheep and goats outside when the bombs fell, and that's what saved me." Zamina Ahmad, somebody else, was awakened by the airplanes roaring overhead and heard the deafening boom of a bomb dropping close by. Her first thought was to get out of the house. Grabbing her son, Sabir, 5, she ran into the courtyard of the sprawling family compound, searching for a safe place to hide. Behind her in the house, her daughter, Shaida, cowered in her bed, too terrified to run. As the door banged shut, she heard the deafening rattle of gunfire from the sky. She looked out of the glassless window in time to see her mother slump, lifeless, to the ground. This was a strafing attack by an AC-130 gunship. And I can just go on. I mean, there are an endless amount of these kinds of first-hand stories. Samiullah was asleep, and so on and so forth. Mohammed Raza was a simple man, not the kind that anyone would expect to claim a place in history. He was actually one of the first people killed in the bombing of Jalalabad. And it just goes on and on and on. And many of the refugees who have been interviewed, particularly in the refugee camps in Pakistan, have very similar stories to tell of families, of friends, of neighbors, of neighborhoods, being devastated by, it's not really carpet bombing. The carpet bombing was really more the front lines. These were bombing attacks carried out by F-14, 16, and 18s with so-called JDM 1,000, 2,000-pound smart weapons, which turn out to be not very smart, and, creating this kind of devastation. The entire Afghan hospital system was destroyed, or most of it was destroyed, simply because people fled. Doctors and nurses and staff from major hospitals in Kandahar and Kabul. They also ran out of supplies, but they also simply fled because it was simply dangerous to be in any kind of structure. Central Marketplace was hit in Kandahar, killing upwards of 20, 30 people. What was the target? Well, the target was a government building, which was where? In the center of town, of course, not out in the Kandahar desert. So the refugee accounts really corroborate the magnitude, the dispersion across space of the bombing. And if your readers or you yourself want to look at the data chart, which is available on the internet, you will see that there are actually relatively few incidents of large numbers of people being killed. What we're talking about is 5, 10, 15 being killed in many, many different places. And that's how you get up to that figure of, on average, 62 a day. So it's a very decentralized pattern of bombing and air attacks, with the qualification that when the bombing of the front lines began and carpet bombing ensued, well, that was somewhat different. And one of the terrible things about the frontline bombing was that the way the front line existed in northern Afghanistan around Kunduz and Khananabad and Mazar and in the Somali plain, the front line really kind of weaved in and out across a plain and a mountain ridge through small villages. And these small villages happened to be on the front line, and they were bombed. And people hadn't fled. Many people hadn't fled from those villages, unlike, say, in, you know, Kandahar and Kabul and Kunduz and Mazar-e-Sharif and Herat. And so that phase of heavy carpet bombing of the front lines annihilated many mountain and plains villages. We actually have pictures of some of those bombings. In fact, I believe on the cover of the report, there's a picture of the village of Daryakana being obliterated. And these are small villages of mud huts. We see the bombs dropping and hitting, and there's just this enormous brown cloud which emerges, and everything disintegrates. You know, there are many, many, many of the personal stories which are around refugee stories, people who were on the site of a particular, you know, incident and the like. They're all out there, and it's just a matter of collecting them, and that's one of the projects I'm working on right now is really putting together a collection of these individual stories to supplement the more aggregative, lifeless numbers which I have.
One of the stories you include in your report that really wrenched me was the one about the Kandahar merchant who had gone to the trouble of bringing his family to what he thought was safety in shuttling them in several cars, those cars being bombed. And the irony was that, in fact, the way that he brought them probably sent a signal to the U.S. flyers in the aircraft that this was probably a military convoy.
Absolutely. The lights of the car. At that time of the war, this was the third phase of the air war. At that time, to use this sort of Orwellian language, which has been used by Victoria Clark in her statements at the Pentagon, at that time we were, the U.S. fighter jets and bombers were moving toward Victoria Clark's targets of opportunity. And the targets of opportunity at that time in the last 3 weeks, early December, late November, included literally anything and everything that was moving on the highways of the southern and southeastern provinces of Afghanistan. And you know, the example you cited is an example of that. But there are many, many other examples of it. The example of a couple trucks running out of gas or developing motor problems and parking on the side of the road, and the driver is going to sleep, and, well, this is, you know, detected as a series of vehicles in the dark and is bombed at 3 a.m. Or the constant attacks upon fuel-carrying trucks. They became very much a target, that trucks carrying fuel, most of Afghanistan's fuel comes by truck. In fact, I believe all of it comes by truck from Iran down the big highway from Iran to Herat and on to Kandahar and then back up to Kabul. There are many, many reports of fuel trucks being bombed. And what makes it, I think, in a way even more tragic is that some of these were carrying refugees who were basically hitching a ride in desperation to move to the refugee camps. And they, in effect, hitchhiked a ride to death as the fuel trucks were incinerated. And there are reports on that. There are reports on trucks carrying fruit to Pakistan being hit, with the drivers and everybody else being killed. There are reports of a fuel truck carrying cooking oil being destroyed. There are reports of tractors with carts behind them being destroyed. A very serious incident in Tarin Kot, which is the capital of Uruzgan, a mountainous province. That was one of the really serious incidents where a larger family was fleeing on a tractor with a cart, and the whole thing was bombed. The nearest military facility was 2.5 miles away. So something's wrong here. Either this weaponry is really dumb, or it's basically a policy of hitting anything which moves. And I think this raises some very, very serious questions about what was a legitimate target. And I hope that this will become a subject of some research, some study to greater depth than I've done here, and ultimately of some investigation. Because I really do think that the Afghan people here have suffered in a way which should never have been. I don't want to make any assertion here about, you know, the people in New York didn't suffer in a way which, of course, they shouldn't have suffered. I mean, obviously not. I think that when civilians die as a result of a targeting of something, whether it's a military facility such as in Afghanistan or whether it's a symbol of political, economic, financial might, which gets destroyed and civilians die, this is terrible. It's terrible. And I guess I wish that we would not have a double standard. It's terrible wherever it happens, and it should not happen anywhere.
What's your response to the claim that focusing on civilian deaths supports the enemy propaganda effort, that a report like yours is, in fact, plays right into the Taliban's hands?
Well, I think that's a political statement, which is part and parcel of keeping the focus upon the justness, if you want, of the American military effort. And so I reject that. I think that reporting on the war should be as full and thorough as possible. And I think that, for example, on the Vietnam War, if we go back to that era, we had a fair number of reporters on the ground reporting on the gory details of the war in Vietnam. And I think that that is something which everybody should hear about. It is part of the waging of war. And to think that a war can be waged akin to a video game in an arcade where, you know, you're shooting only at the bad guys and the good guys survive is, I think, a lie. And so it's very important, I think, for people to hear about the totality of the war in order to be informed and to make some kind of call on where they stand. And without this kind of information and these kinds of reports and documenting, as I meant to, you know, emphasize again, I mean, this was reported in newspapers, for example, in Britain, in The Independent and The Guardian, and BBC Online News was great. It's just that here, you didn't get any of that. This was a packaged, programmed effort to maintain uncritical support for a war which, you know, the administration decided to wage. So I don't think it plays into the hands of anybody. I'm certainly not relying on dubious sources. I've tried to the best of my possible ability to use, you know, very credible reports. And again, to, you know, underline, these were reports which were out in India and in Pakistan and in Britain and in France and in Germany and Australia. But, you know, relatively little of it was here. Or if it was presented here, it would be occasionally found on, you know, page 36 of the Los Angeles Times or, you know, page 28 of the New York Times. I think it's a very important part of a war. And in the reporting on the war in Vietnam and Cambodia and Indochina, we were able to see that part of the war. And I think that that served to some extent, to, you know, change the attitude towards the war. And the same thing holds with regards to casualties. I think that the Pentagon and the military were absolutely scared stiff of casualties. I suspect that there are also underestimates here of U.S. casualty figures. I think that will probably come out in the open somewhat later on. And that, too, I think was part of the packaging of the war. So it's not about support for the enemy. It's for a free flow of information in a society which calls itself a democracy.
And in fact, it seems there is a correlation between those countries that did actually report on and have actually reported on civilian casualties in Afghanistan and the public's views of the U.S. war there, where they've actually had information flowing freely. The public doesn't seem so enamored with continuing the U.S. aerial bombardments.
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt about that. And I think the contrast between, say, Britain and the United States is very clear on that, let alone countries like Germany and France and Italy and Spain and so on. You know, it was very much an intended effect, and I think this was it's a legacy in some ways of Vietnam, where you know the military and political elite perceived the reporting on the Vietnam era to be something hampering their unchallenged authority, and this was learned. And I think the rehearsal for this was with the Iraq War, which was already, I think, pretty packaged, but not as much as this one. I think this is a couple notches above the reporting on the Iraq War.
What has been the media response here in the U.S. as well as worldwide to your report since it's come out?
Well, that's very interesting. There was an incredible response on the internet, a large, large number of individuals, of organizations, of alternative news media sources responded extremely favorably. I got one single out of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, one single horrible comment with invective and, you know, all the rest, which I simply didn't respond to. So that's been extremely positive. I have not heard from mainstream media type here, although I believe that that's changing. I think that the report was picked up yesterday or possibly this morning in the St. Louis Dispatch, and there's been an enormous number of radio interviews. I've actually been invited to certain television programs, which I have not gone to. I have a job at the end of the semester, and I have responsibilities at the university here and towards my students, so I will not do that. But I've had a lot of radio interviews. And as to the geographic scope of the interest, it's amazing. I mean, from Australia to New Zealand to all over Europe. I had a very nice interview with a leading journalist in Sweden, to Canada, to literally all over the United States, Japan. It just goes on and on. So I'm very happy about that. I mean, the idea was here to put out something which I felt comfortable about in terms of, you know, the research quality under very difficult circumstances. This is a very difficult topic to do research on, but I felt comfortable that it was about as good as could be done. And, you know, lo and behold, it's really been picked up. The internet has been an extraordinary medium in terms of getting these kinds of messages out. You know, in a way, again, I'm not surprised by, because it was on the internet and through the internet that I myself gathered the data to compile this report. So maybe it's not in the Washington Post and the New York Times and the Boston Globe, but there is a lot of information out on the internet, and it seems to me there's a lot of interest in this dimension of the war. So that didn't really surprise me. Bottom line, I was taken back by the magnitude of the response and the incredibly positive response. I mean, the thankfulness on the part of so many individuals, so many groups, so many organizations. I had no idea that it would be so widely cited, so widely supported. And that was really, really gratifying. I've received a few excellent criticisms, which I think were made in the spirit of, you know, trying to improve on the quality of the report. And I'm very happy to have those. I want this to be something which is looked at and questioned in a serious way, and I certainly welcome those kinds of suggestions, and I've gotten a few and tried to address them.
And where on the internet can people find your report?
Let's see, there are a number of different places. The best presentation and up-to-date version of the report, and we're adding to this as the days go by, is at www.cursor.org/stories/civilian, then it's not a hyphen, but the line down below.
Underscore?
The underlying, and then deaths, plural of death, deaths.htm. That is the essay. And then the database, you know, I put that out in the public domain so people can look at it, is at my university site, which is https://pubpages://unh.edu/tilde/MW Herold, H-E-R-O-L-D, altogether lowercase. And there's an Excel version and an HTML version, and I believe we're going to get a PDF version up very soon, too. But it's widely available on the Internet in different versions. All one has to do is just go to Google, the Google search engine, and punch in my name or punch in civilian casualties in Afghanistan. It'll come up. Many, many, many organizations have reproduced the report on their home site, including, I might mention, some libraries in the country. So that's been really gratifying. And I'm continually adding. A person who read the report offered to do something which I had wanted to do. I hadn't done it yet. That is to take a map of Afghanistan and plot the geographic dispersion of the casualty figures, since I do report the place, this, and I got a wonderful, beautiful map this morning on the Internet from this fellow, and we will shortly be including that in the report at the cursor site as a table. So this plots civilian casualties by area on a map in Afghanistan. This was done by somebody who was very excited by the report and had the skills to do this, and it looks fantastic. It really is, and this will be table 4 to the essay. At this point, I believe there are 3 tables and 4 appendices, so this will be the 4th table. And I've had offers by other people to do some really interesting work also with the data, and also to look at areas which I think this report allows beginning to look at. So in that sense, too, I'm really happy that it's something which people can use to continue and do some more work on this.
Any last thoughts or comments you'd like to relay to our listeners?
Well, I think that the toll of 62 persons a day dying is very high, and it's an underestimate, and to that must be added all the others who have suffered. There are countless injuries, and one can play games like, doing injuries per death ratios and getting some kind of indication of the extent of the suffering. And to that must be added all the indirect effects, the 15 or 20,000 cluster bombs which are spread now across Afghanistan, the destruction of public infrastructure from roads to hydroelectric plants to telephone exchanges, to the list is endless. This was already an extremely poor country. It was a country which had gone through 10 years of civil war, followed by 4 or 5 or 6 years of further terrible fighting amongst the various factions in Afghanistan. And, here we have yet another tragedy befalling this already devastated land. This is a human tragedy of, I think, enormous proportion, and we should do everything we can to help remedy whatever is possible and make life somewhat more bearable for the average Afghan. And that includes, in this winter, supporting all the efforts of relief organizations to bring in food to what is sometimes estimated to be 2, 3, 4 million people vulnerable to starvation and cold. But this is an enormous human tragedy. Maybe one last thing I'll mention on that is that the cluster bombs and the bombing generally has led to a very significant number of injured persons, people without legs, people without arms, people without limbs. Afghanistan is primarily an agricultural society. How do you farm without a leg, without a foot, without an arm? This is a further legacy of this continued attack and this continued war vested upon the Afghan people.